We'll be talking about sexuality, and it really does fit into this spot within the series. We've been going through our Family by Design series, and it really does fit into that. Actually, I was just thinking before I go on, I wanted to acknowledge our decorating committee. They spent many hours here this week getting the church together, so please, if you know who they are and see them, please thank them for all the work they put in. But yeah, last week I talked about spiritual parenting, and today is a topic that we all need to talk about, and certainly something that we need to be talking to our kids about, because it's such a pivotal part of life and relationships and marriage. It's one thing that deeply impacts our identity as people, our concept of who God is, the kinds of relationships we have. And so this morning I want to talk tactfully, but honestly, and even compassionately about an area that we all are impacted by in one way or another. So we want to, it's really important that we talk about this gift of sexuality. And it really is a gift. Sometimes we don't see it as that, especially if it's an area that we struggle in our relationships. But it is really a gift that God has given us. And one reason why I really want to talk about it is just because of what's going on in our culture, that God's gift has been distorted in the absence of teaching. So few of us have had any kind of conversation with someone who has a healthy history of sexuality. And because there's been an absence of it in families, in relationships, and certainly within the church, there's a vacuum. And a vacuum doesn't remain a vacuum. It naturally sucks in other things. And so if we have an absence of biblical teaching on sexuality, other things are going to define it for us. And so in our highly sexualized Western culture, and it's actually not even just in the West, but there's other things that are defining our sexuality and what a quality relationship looks like. And so there's many different sources, and we don't have to look far to see the confusion, the pain, the abuse that has come as a result of distorted views of an awesome gift that God has given us as people. As a result of it, many people, Christians included, have bought into a lot of lies when it comes to sexuality. One is God is anti-sex. God doesn't want anything to do with it. God's a cosmic killjoy. He wants to take any kind of joy out of that experience. That if you're a Christian, you have to engage in very boring sexual practices. It's completely out of touch with reality. A lot of people think that, if love is present, and you'll notice in our culture we don't define what love is, but anyways, if love is present, then sex is okay. God's okay with it as long as you just love each other. These are all lies that a lot of Christians and certainly our world has bought into. Now, if you look at the Bible is very clear and even explicit, and dare I even say erotic, when it comes to sex. It is a topic of the Christian life that the Bible doesn't shy about. It's not awkward about. It's actually very explicit. And God, the Bible calls us to relish and enjoy our spouse. And so this morning I want to talk about that. But first we need to acknowledge some of the historical views of sex. The first one would be that it's an unavoidable appetite. That it's like hunger. So if you're hungry, you eat food. It's just you have to do it to survive. And so it's completely unavoidable. And just like you can cook whatever you want at the end of the day or for a meal and try different things, sex is the same. Whatever flavor, anytime, anywhere, anyone, it's all okay because the most important is just being satisfied and being fulfilled. You can do it in any kind of variety. So it's an unavoidable appetite. It's a necessary evil. This is probably what most of you or some of you have heard, that we're designed as sexual beings and God has called us to have kids, and so it's a necessary evil. It's kind of gross and it's supposed to be private and kind of, disgusting, but we got to do it to have kids, so you just kind of keep the lights off, okay? It's okay to laugh. You can relax. It's okay. It's all right. So it's procreation's important, but we don't want to go there too much because somehow it's wrong. Okay? Another one is it's a critical self-expression. Now this is our culture today. So it's unavoidable in the first instance, but the last instance is absolutely necessary. It's a part of me discovering who I am and my self-expression and it's liberating myself and I'm finding who I am by expressing my sexuality. And so it's absolutely critical that we do it. So there's probably others, but these are some of the generally the historical views that people have on sex. And probably most of us who've grown up in the church, we kind of fit in the middle there somewhere. Okay. We're going to look at 1 Corinthians. We're going to be anchored there. We're going to look at a few different passages. We're going to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And Paul is writing to a church in very confusing times. The church in Corinth, it was an industrial city, a trade city, lots happening, and so it invited people from all walks of life. And it was a very, you know, it's like the Las Vegas of the time. And so a lot of the Christians that had come to know Christ came out of a very immoral lifestyle. Sex was very public. You could walk down the street and there was, you know, different temples and things like that you can go and engage in different activities. It was part of temple worship. And so when you come to know Christ, I mean, just imagine the confusion and so on that came with relationships and following Jesus. And so very confusing times. And Paul is writing to people, even within the church, who are justifying their behavior, justifying the expression of their sexuality. And so he confronts we're going to start at chapter 6, verse 12. He challenges some of their slogans and some of their thinking. And, you know, hopefully you would find us in these as well, because we quickly justify our behavior. So first in verse 12, you might have known, quoted these verses, but you might have missed some key things. Verse 12, "Everything is permissible for me, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Food for the stomach and the stomach for food, but God will destroy them both. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body." I don't know if you've ever quoted these verses before, and if you have, you most likely missed the quotation marks. We often say, hey, everything is permissible for me, but you notice that that's a quote. Paul is quoting slogans and things that people live their life by. So everything's permissible for me, you know, food for the stomach and the stomach for the food. These things, this is just an appetite, they go together, so it's okay. And Paul kind of puts in his own little commentary after and says, yeah, but wait a minute, it's not beneficial. It's going to lead you somewhere. And eventually, a lot of these things are destroyed. So the slogans that you're living by, Christians, don't apply. They apply in our culture, but they don't necessarily apply to you. And so he's challenging these justifications that, well, everybody's doing it, and it's kind of okay. I'm not really hurting anybody. It's just an appetite I have. But Paul says, whoa, your body is not your own. It's united with Christ. And so don't live by these slogans that most of our culture is. And so he challenges them. He challenges them in a way by saying, you know, God created this. Really, why I'm talking about this morning is because God created it. God ordained it. God put two people together to experience something completely beyond expression. Verse 14, "By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Should I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never." Remember the context here. "Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh. But he who unites himself with the Lord is one with him in spirit." God is saying that our sexuality is actually found in the resurrection. It's found in who God is. God raised Jesus from the dead, and he has united us with him through his Spirit. So the whole concept of relationships is unity. It's binding yourself together. That's the whole Christian walk. And so God created unity, and then when he created man and woman, he created unity. He created unity. He created oneness. And so our sexuality is found in God himself and in all of creation, even in the salvation message. Sex is bonding. Sex brings us together in a very powerful way. And he's saying here, you can't bind to Christ something that is anti-Christ, that is sexual immorality, prostitution, or exploitation, experimentation, all of these things that we engage in. In the beginning, he created man and woman, and the two became one flesh. God created unity when he created man. He created unity when he followed through on salvation. He created unity when he created marriage. And so God created it. It's not something to be disgusted by or anything. It's a beautiful gift he's given us. So this morning, I'm talking about it because God created it. I'm also talking about it because sin distorts it. Sin challenged this area of the life so significantly. In verse 18, Paul goes on, he says, "Flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a man commits are outside his body. But he who sins sexually sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your body." Sin wants to attack this area because it's so significant to the Christian life. Because it's my own body. It's my inner heart. It's where Christ lives. It actually affects my bonding to Jesus and my relationship in him. And sin wants to attack that. So why are all of our marriages struggling in some way? Or are we growing in our sexuality? Why is our culture becoming so sexualized? And all cultures before us and probably after us. Because it's a sin of the heart. It's a sin of our bodies. And it attacks where we connect with God. You know, it's also, I'm talking about it because traditionally the church has ignored it. If God creates it, sin distorts it. We need to talk about it. So if you ever do some study of the church in history, the church has been very anti-sex. Through interest of appeasing a whole bunch of festivals and things like that, there was actually only about 52 days in the whole year the church permitted people to have sex. 52 days. You know, Monday there was this festival. You have to remember this because of that. And this is the Sabbath, so you can't do it then. And, oh, yeah, then there's all the other festivals. You need to be like Advent, you couldn't do it now because you're preparing for Christmas and all of this kind of stuff. And so there's very few days in the year that the church would permit people, let alone menstruation and all those other factors, pregnancy. There was a negative aspect of the church. Augustine, one of the great church fathers, said that original sin was transmitted through sex. I mean, it was completely wrong teaching. And so the church has been very negative when it comes to that. How many of you, I don't know if you want to raise your hands, but anyways, how many of you who did go through premarriage counseling had your premarriage counselor actually talk about sex? Whoa, I'm impressed. Well, some of you did it with me, so okay. Well, that's encouraging. I wasn't sure if you'd put your hand up. I mean, I would do way more now as I study and learn, but I mean, I got a set of tapes. Some of you would, yeah, Glenn and I had the same marriage counselor. Some of you had 8 tracks, right? Yeah, no, just kidding. Here's a book, go read about it, because I don't dare talk to you about it. The church has ignored it. But you know, sex is like a fire in a fireplace. Great, great picture. I mean, if you wanted to light a fire, how many of you done this in the middle of your living room? Okay, a fire is a very powerful, effective thing when you do it properly, when you do it in the right place. You light a fire in within boundaries, within something that's going to protect it. Okay, you put it in a fireplace because it's not going to spread. You put a screen in front of it. Okay, and then the power and the warmth and the light and everything that is designed to give off is there, and it's helpful, it's productive. But the second you go outside of its design, it's incredibly destructive, incredibly painful. So outside of boundaries, sex is the same. It's a very powerful gift that God's given us. It's to be done in a very unique environment. It's supposed to be for our joy, our protection, our warmth, our bonding, everything that God designed it for. But we're in a culture and an age, probably like every other age, where we don't want those boundaries. And quite frankly, we have so many examples of the destruction. When God designed you to enjoy it within the context of a marriage. And it does impact your children. It does become a part of your spiritual parenting. And so it bonds you together as a couple. It bonds you together in every aspect of life. And that flows through to your kids. And you foster a healthy sexuality among our kids. You know, the message of abstaining before marriage is not because we have a low view of sex. It's actually because we have such a high view of sex. It is so worth it, and it's so priceless that we have to do it within the right context. So this morning, the point is that the sex is a glorious act. It really is a glorious act that progressively expresses love and thanksgiving. And I mean progressively because we're all in process of understanding. We're all in the process of learning each other and doing it appropriately. And so going through that process is also something that's supposed to be ongoing. And we're going to talk about that this morning. So Paul continues on in chapter 7 explaining what he already touches on, that man and woman have come together to be one flesh. And he's going to say, well, how do we do that? What is it and how do we move forward with it? It's just not physical. When we talk about once being one flesh and a man and woman coming together, we think of the physical act, but it's so much more than that. So much more. And if you've experienced a healthy sex life, you would understand what I'm talking about. And what makes it more is that it's, if you can click on the thing, I think it stopped. Thank you. It's making and renewing a binding covenant. It's just not making love. It's just not something you do in a bedroom. It's actually making and constantly renewing a binding covenant between two people. So let's read verses 1 to 7 of chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians. And so he's picking up on specifically what the Corinth church is working through. Because again, walk down Las Vegas or any place like that, Bangkok, or if you've gone to any of those other downtown Edmonton, in all the stores, that's what Corinth was like, okay? Now for the matters you wrote about. Is it good for a man to not marry? Or it is good for a man to not marry. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a consent, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am, but to each man has his own gift from God, and one has a gift, another has that. So here Paul is talking about how do we go through this? Well, first of all, in making a covenant. A covenant is a surrendering of your life. It's making a commitment that you're going to unite your lives in every aspect. It's not just physical, but it's emotional. It's social, emotional, economically, everything. It's a commitment that together we're uniting our lives. And you can't do that unless it's public. So a marriage ceremony actually really has nothing to do with the contract, the piece of paper. But what it does have to do with is me standing before a group of people and saying to my wife that I'm committing to you uniting every aspect of my life with you. And now we could do that privately, but God doesn't have us do anything privately. The whole concept of salvation and baptism and community like this is that we do it together. And so I said that to my wife in the context of people because what I'm doing is I'm calling them into my accountability. You watched me make this commitment to her, and she knows that too, and she did the same. And now we're calling you as a community into our lives to help us make this work. And so when the weddings I do, I always start by saying, hey, you're all here not to observe and enjoy the party and have a free supper. You're here to be their accountability. You're here to help them unite every aspect of their life together ongoing. And what happens at the end of that night, if possible? There's a consummation of that. There's a finalization to that. There's a stamp of approval between the two people, and that's the sex on the wedding night. It's a complete celebration and culmination, a climax of the celebration of that whole day. It's a climax of bonding together. And it's incredibly bonding. It's making a covenant. And so that's why in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, it says, a man shall leave his mother and father and be united to his wife. And it's on that day. Every culture in every part of the world through all of time have had some kind of marriage ceremony that involved the whole culture, the whole community, and being a part of the making of this covenant. It's also a renewal, something we need to do consistently. And so we don't stand up all the time in front of people and say our vows again, but actually we're doing that when we have sex again. And so part of a healthy marriage is to reaffirm the vows we've made to each other, that I give my whole self to you. Everything I have is to you. And when we have sex again, what you're doing is you're reclaiming your vows. You're celebrating your life together and how you're coming together as a couple. In the Old Testament, if you look through the whole Old Testament, the people of God had consistent Old Testament renewal celebrations and ceremonies. Quite often they'd come together and they would read the law and everything about it, and everybody would say, yes, we again commit to that. Well, that's the picture of marriage, of reaffirming. And this is what it means by duty. When Paul says you have a duty, kind of sounds cold, doesn't it? Like I've got a job description I got to fulfill. Well, no, Paul's saying, no, you have, it's not out of an obligation, but it's actually something that you're doing to follow through with your commitment. Okay, you're reaffirming that and you're giving yourself to that person. Paul picks up on this in Ephesians chapter 5. You can go and read that. We've been there several times over the week, but he challenges the man, your body's not your own, and you're to love your wife and to serve her and nourish her and encourage her, because you guys are now one. Your bodies are each other's. And so you treat her how you would treat your own body, and you do that by eating and sleeping and nourishing and strengthening yourself. Will you do that to your spouse? And there he says, you do that as Christ did to the church. And so Paul brings all aspects of the Christian life back to Jesus, including sex. It comes back to his selflessness, his service, his nourishment, his encouragement, his self-giving act. So in making and renewing a covenant, sex is safe, it's self-giving, it's extremely vulnerable, it's uplifting, it's physical, it's emotional, it's spiritual, it's uniting, it's oneness. So it's way more than physical. It's a binding together of two lives. But we also see that it's knowing and being known. So this should kind of ring a bell. We've talked about this before. But we see this play out in a marriage relationship as well. Being known and coming to know. In Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, it says there that Adam, some of your translations will say he lay with Eve and they conceived and Cain was born. But quite often, some translations translate that word wrong or at least incomplete. Adam did not just lay with Eve, he knew her. The Hebrew word there is yada, and some translations translate it better and says that Adam knew Eve. And they conceived and had Cain. And if you look at what that word yada or knew means, or to know, it means this. It means to know properly one another, to experience one another, to discover one another, to give to one another, to have one another, to take from one another, to be privy to one another, to be sure of. And so in the making and the binding of a covenant, when a husband and wife goes through this process of, I know you, I see you, I understand you, I'm coming to see the beauty in you. And that's what you're celebrating. And it's a process of truly understanding and getting to know each other in the most deepest way. It involves the entire person, spirit, body, heart, soul, all of that. So it's to make and renew a covenant, and to go through this process of truly, deeply knowing one another. There's a great picture, analogy of marriage and sexuality, and it's a steam pipe. All right, so a steam pipe. If you think of the pressures underneath there, and if you were to examine the pipe, these pipes all have faults within them. They all have weak points. Now you can try to stave off some kind of bursting of the pipe by opening a valve once in a while. Right? Leave some of the pressure, and then it won't burst. Well, if you do that, and if that's your way of going about life and relationships, over time, the corrosion is still going to happen. That weak spot is going to get weaker and weaker and weaker, and eventually it will burst. And this valve won't make a difference anymore because you've got a hole in the pipe. Well, we're designed like that as people. We have weak spots in ourselves, and we have weak spots in our relationships. And so you can go about ways of trying to blow off steam. And a lot of people, that's what sex is. It's we're avoiding the problem. We don't want to deal with the hard stuff, and we're just kind of relieve some pressure, as it were, and somehow we're all happy. But when that becomes your way of dealing with your life, outside of marriage or within your marriage, the original problem continues to fester, continues to grow, and continues to break you down. And eventually that valve doesn't work anymore. And the bitterness and the hurt and the resentment is somewhat permanent because you haven't dealt with the issues. And so why the Bible talks about marriage and the sex in the context of a healthy marriage, it's because you're preparing yourself. You're dealing with the issues in the pipe so that the valve isn't even needed. You're strong, and everything sex is supposed to be is there. And so I want to talk about the pitfalls. And the first one is premarital sex, having sex beyond marriage in some way, okay? There's an eroding effect to your sexuality and to you as a person and to your relationship when you have sex outside of marriage. There's a whole bunch of reasons. We don't have time to go through it all, but there's a great article called The Eroding Effect of Premarital Sex. I have several books on marriage that talks about it. I also have a book called The Ring Makes All the Difference, talking about just even statistically what happens to a couple who get married who have had premarital sex. A couple things. Well, first of all, it's an obvious one, is it's disobedient. The Bible is explicit when it comes to sex in the confines of marriage. And so we have this attitude within the church, well, God loves and he forgives, and so I'm kind of obedient in every other way of my life, so it's not so bad. When God says, no, this is not what I designed it for. There are consequences to doing it outside of marriage. Another one is artificial intimacy. What happens is when we have sex outside of marriage, we feel intimate without all actually cultivating true intimacy. And so it's kind of like that valve thing. And so what we continue this process of relieving pressure or just going with my feelings without actually fostering intimacy. But what happens is over time, the feeling of sexuality goes away. And all of a sudden, it's not a remedy anymore. And again, hurt, loss, pain, confusion starts to set in. Bitterness. And so it's never a remedy. It's a celebration. It's something that comes out of a healthy relationship. It's not something that creates one. So we get this sense, a feeling of intimacy for the short term. It's there for sure for the short term, but it doesn't last. My marriage counselor said, you know, sex gets way better the older you get. And I went, whatever. It's true. It's true. And it's because you discover each other. You come to know each other. And it is true. It is true that the making, the binding, and the knowing truly does come as you work through all aspects of life and sexuality in the way God designed. But something that was really informative to me, another reason why premarital is so significant, so dangerous, is you also get something called an artificial arousal. And see, you know, in all of areas of sin of our life, there's something exciting about it. Let's be honest. You know, when we engage in something outside of marriage, there's a bit of an arousal to it. There's deeply down inside, you know, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but I kind of like it. And we are programmed as people to need that as a condition for intimacy. It starts to become one of the ingredients for us to have any kind of intimacy with another person. And so the more you engage in that before God, outside of marriage, in a way that God did not design, it becomes a significant ingredient. And so if you as a couple then get married, or if you had premarital sex and then you are married and you've struggled, what happens on the wedding night? Well, there's no more immorality to it. It's all okay. There's nothing secret to it anymore. Everybody knows what's going on. And so all of a sudden the wrongness, which was a condition for arousal, is gone. And then you look at each other and you say, well, how come I'm not feeling the same? What happened on the wedding night? Well, you lost this artificial arousal. And it's documented. It's very well known. And so all of these things contribute to a very unhealthy lifestyle after marriage, and it's very difficult to change after the wedding night. How do you then deal with it after you're married? Well, you create some more wrong. You find another partner that you can be secretive with. It might be online. It might be a picture. It might be a person that you go meet somewhere, because now it's wrong. And you know it's wrong. I shouldn't be doing this, but man, it feels good. All of a sudden, that arousal is back. And so often, so many marriages fall apart because the conditioning has led them to unhealthy habits. I need to move on. Another pitfall, folks, is withdrawal. Paul talks about here, verse 5, do not deprive each other except for mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you. As couples, so often we withdraw. And we look at Genesis chapter 3 when Adam and Eve sinned. What did they do? They hid. They withdrew. There was a shameness to their sexuality. And that happens in relationships. And so when we withdraw for the wrong reasons and we withdraw for long periods of time, it leaves an emotional, relational, spiritual, physical vacuum that temptation comes in and takes hold. And so withdrawal can be very dangerous. Another pitfall is an obvious one, is substitutes. Pornography, Facebook, reality TV, romance novels, soap operas, even friends, even ministries. All of these things can become substitutes for true intimacy and true knowing. And so we need to see it as that, as a substitute. Well, we need to keep moving. What difference could this make if we work towards making, binding, and renewing, and knowing? Sex becomes a powerful picture of a deepening spiritual reality, a very powerful picture. Now, notice how I'm saying it's a picture. It's something that's coming out of a reality. So again, it's not something that feeds into a reality. Okay? So it comes out of a reality. God created marriage to exemplify the gospel. And he created the gospel to lead us to marriage and sexuality. Because God created it. It's a beautiful thing. He meant it to be a glorious thing, to be completely enjoyed and completely captivated by as a couple. Physical and spiritually, relationally, in all aspects, it's a very high view of sexuality. We see that in a couple of many places throughout Scripture. We're going to talk about it in a second. But some of you might be thinking, this is just church stuff. It's too far beyond me. And I guess I want to challenge you this morning that know that you've never gone too far. You've never gone down that road of hurt, of mistakes. The whole mystery of the gospel is that you've never run too far. That Jesus has come to you to offer you a renewal and a new way forward. The fire can be returned to the fireplace. There are consequences, but that's the nature of the gospel, is that there can be renewal. And so what you have to do is be honest with yourself. You need to be honest with your partner. You need to bring somebody in who can guide you and give you some new tools to move forward. There needs to be a repentance, a change of mind, a change of theology, a change of understanding, and there needs to be some accountability. But just as a general statement, you've never gone too far. Never. And there can be renewal to your sexual life. The next thing, if you're married, is understand your spouse. You can look up books like Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. You know, I'm a waffle and she's a spaghetti, pile of spaghetti, right? Have you ever heard those analogies? We're completely two different people. And I've had that said to me in many marriage situations. Well, we're two completely different people. Well, I said, yeah, so are Myrna and I. You're created that way. That's part of the beauty of it, is because you're called into a selflessness, to a sacrificialness, to a givingness. Because that's the gospel. So we have to go through a process of knowing each other. You know, men need the physical to become relational. And women need the relational to become physical. So from the very beginning, we're on complete opposite ends of the same thing. And so it calls us to a selflessness. It's called to understand, my role as a man. What's her process of coming to know and be known? and for her to understand what's my process of coming to know and be known. And so, you know, the big joke for women is, well, sex starts in the kitchen. You got to wash some dishes, make some lunches, vacuum a floor, you know, things like that. Just coming into a space that equips a woman to be free of all the stresses of life, to be able to know and be known. Ladies, you need to know that we're completely visual. Now, these are broad strokes, I realize that. But, you know, men are typically very visual. And you need to know that as women and girls in our very highly sexualized culture. Church people continue to dress completely inappropriately. Now, is it the man's responsibility to, as Paul says in Colossians, you know, put your mind on things above? Yes. But you also have a responsibility to know how God has uniquely designed us and to dress modestly and to not lead a man down the road that God did not intend him to go. So be responsible with how you dress. Men are like light bulbs. You flick on the power and it's hot. You can laugh, that's okay. I love the analogy of another preacher. He said, and women are like irons. You turn them on and they're still cold. But eventually they kind of get there, all right? You know, that's a broad. But we have to understand your spouse. Ask some questions. And you know, the other thing, and this isn't necessarily the funny part, is there's some significant barriers in life. There's a whole lot of pain when it comes to our sexuality. The statistics of sexual abuse is just beyond belief. So you might be inheriting something that is deeply hurt, and you need to go into that space carefully. As you know, men sometimes experience impotence, and it might be permanent. Well, how do you deal with that? You know, there's obviously menstruation. If you've had a child, then there's implications physically as a result of that. So just taking time to talk carefully, considerately, compassionately, especially for women, if there's unresolved conflict, is very difficult. Because the relational is intact, to have any kind of physical. And so men, we need to be considerate of that. So communicate, which is the next point. Understand yourselves by communicating. Before, yes, during, and even after. Understand, how are you feeling, what's going on, and what's helpful, what's not helpful, how are you know, communicate. It's very uncomfortable, especially for us guys, but communication is so important to understanding one another. And finally, folks, we need to celebrate it. Okay, it's not an act. No one's obligated to do anything. This is truly a celebration of my commitment to you and your commitment to me and us doing life together, every aspect of life. Coming together and celebrating that. It's a glorious, powerful experience when it's done the way that God has designed it to be. You know, the Bible, hear me appropriately as a guide, but the Bible is incredibly explicit and erotic when it comes to sexuality. It's because God created it. It's beautiful. And so there's some great passages. Now I'm gonna read one or a couple, and I hope we receive them well. But in Proverbs chapter 5, it's typically a book that talks about adultery, and we think that's the message, but that's not the message. It's actually a push to enjoy and be consumed by your spouse, and this is more written to men. So I'm just going to read two verses. Chapter 5, verse 18, he's talking to his son, and he says, may your fountain be blessed, and that's your relationship with your wife, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breasts satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. That's just one of many explicit verses about how we're to enjoy one another. Now, you women will be thinking, well, of course he is. Of course he's going to enjoy that. That's how he's wired. Yes. The whole book of Song of Solomon, folks, is written from a female's perspective. And you see this relationship between a man and a woman who she is just captivated by. She's enthralled by her spouse. And so most of that book, the most explicit book, probably, is written from a female perspective. And I'll just read two verses of chapter 8 of Song of Solomon. It's kind of the climax of the whole book. It says, she says, place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. It's jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. It's meant something to be celebrated. It's a glorious experience. And so there's no shame when it comes to the sexuality of a husband and a wife. But there is parameters to it. I created some questions there for you again in the bulletin for you to talk together as couples. You might not have an idea of where to start in this whole discussion. But we'd be honest. You know, what unbiblical views about sex have we believed? Is it historical? Is it something we got to keep the lights off and just kind of, you know, because the pastor said we should? Or, you know, what kind of unbiblical views have we bought into? What areas of biblical sex do we need to foster and develop more as a couple? What pitfalls have we fallen into? And what physical and spiritual, relational, emotional, other barriers are inhibiting us to truly celebrate an amazing gift that God has given us? Next week, we're going to talk about the confusion, and more specifically about same-sex marriage and some gender identity things that we really need to talk about as a church because it's a part of our reality. And so we're going to explore that next week more and some other areas of confusion. But I encourage you to explore this with your spouse and talk about it because it is a true gift. I thought, what better way of celebrating or renewing this than communion? The mystery that Paul talks about in Ephesians chapter 5 is that the gospel is an example of marriage, and marriage drives us to the gospel. And a part of marriage is a healthy gift of sexuality. And so we want to come back to the gospel and invite Jesus to come and heal us as broken sexual people. And so I encourage you to come with your spouse. Maybe this is an act that you can do together, or if you're here by yourself, just as a physical response to God, make me whole. And help me to understand this incredible gift you've given me in a way that you've designed me to. Communion is a gift that Jesus gave us to remember what he did for us on the cross. And so this is a remembrance for people who truly have given themselves to Christ. And so if you're kind of still in process of laying down your life and trying to figure this out, I encourage you to maybe not participate. It's a great time just to reflect and consider what God's saying to you. If you've never done that and you would like to give your life to Christ, this is a great way to do that. Come on up, and Ken will be serving on one side. I'll serve on the other. And if you want one of us to pray with you to surrender your life and have this be a part of your reality, we'd be happy to do that. So wasn't the worship team come? We're going to do communion. Feel free to take a significant part of the bread and dip it into the cup. Maybe as a couple, too, you'd like to take it back to your seat and just spend a moment together. It's a great way to take communion. But let me pray for us as we come to this time. Father, thank you for your word. And thank you that you are not embarrassed about this beautiful gift of sexuality that you've given us. Forgive us in the ways that we have tainted this gift. All of us are sexually broken people. And I just pray that we would be able to come to the table and remember appropriately. Renew our covenant with you at this point. And in doing so, we're committing ourselves to entering into a healthy covenant with our spouse, if so applicable. If we're not married here this morning, then God, I just pray that this would now become the example of the kind of woman or man I'd like to be, and what kind of woman or man I'd like to give my life to. And just this, the sexuality that you've given to me, hold it like a precious jewel, a priceless jewel. So that when the time comes, God, it is truly an honoring, glorious thing between me and my spouse. So thank you for the gift of your word and that you touch on all areas of life. And I pray for these people here, regardless of the journey they're on and the experiences they've had, I just pray for renewal to them and healing so that, God, our families would be made whole. We truly follow the design that you have given us as women and men. So thank you again for this time. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.